This is the naked city, the city within the city, like an ugly wound, laid raw. The naked city.
It's time for another rambunctious, mind-popping, heart-stopping, lobe-lopping, huge and whopping edition of The Naked City, of course, brought to you by Sydney Film School. Challenge the status quo, people. SydneyFilmSchool.com. Now join us for the next riveting 2 hours as we plunge headlong into a cornucopia of subterranea. You know there are millions of stories in this naked city, but today we've only got time for a few of them. And now your hosts, Miss Death, Coffin Ed, and of course myself, if I don't have a little heart attack here, J-Cats.
Well, good morning, people of Sydney. Our headphones, Coffin Ed, we can't hear a thing. None of us. That's it. That's it. Much Beautiful. Better. A little bit higher, please.
And can I have some stick, please?
Yes. Gee, what a way to start. Well, this morning we were going to do the outside broadcast at Fashion Week, but we decided to dump it, didn't we?
Too much.
I saw some of those fashions. They were
God. Too much stuff popping.
People
out,
are being paid to create out. That stuff. Mm. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No, we've boycotted Fashion Week, particularly when they started using medals. You know.
I haven't got a problem with that.
Well, I had a bit of a problem with
did
that.
Did you? Why is that?
Well, you know,
some of those people should have been getting medals for wearing that stuff.
It was obviously done deliberately to create a bit of you know, sort of
controversy.
Yeah. That. Yeah. You know.
Sounds like a Prince track, doesn't it? Yes, well, we've got a big show today because we've got the one and only Don Lentz coming in at 11 o'clock, and we've got a few other special guests as well. We've got Sam Fielding from the Chevelle Cinema, and they've just recreated their Sunday double bill, which
That's
sounds
right.
beautiful.
Now,
well, was that by getting rid of us?
Yes, it was,
yeah, right,
Miss Death.
Okay.
J-Cats, Don Lentz is the sort of ultimate Renaissance man, isn't he? Tell us a little bit about him, because we want people to actually email questions for Don a little later on.
Well, if you don't know about him, there's no point in emailing a question, really, is there? Well, I mean, that sounds counterproductive to me.
They could send in, who are you? What do you do?
He's the ultimate Renaissance man, isn't he?
I
mean, he was in Big Audio Dynamite, and he didn't play one instrument whatsoever. He just got up the back and mimed. It sounds a bit like your and my career musically, Coffin Ed. We'll have to clarify that with him. He's done just about every clip for The Clash.
He has.
And he did an extraordinary milestone documentary that really tells us that if the revolution came, people would lock the door and ring for Domino's pizzas these days, and that is Punk Attitude, which I think is a seminal documentary saying where is that attitude in today's culture.
It's gone.
So he's a documentarian.
Filmmaker.
DJ, musician.
Extraordinary DJ.
Has a program on the BBC.
I think he introduced ska, reggae and dub to the whole English punk scene
in the
70s. And so he'll have a lot to talk about, but we're actually not going to discuss any of that with him. We're going to take him to the moon because on the New York Times bestseller list this week is Dark Mission, a book I can highly recommend. And I'm only joking about not discussing any of that with him, but I think that book is worth reading.
Absolutely.
Bit upset with the chapter in there on the Kennedy assassination, but hey. What can you do?
You can't do anything.
And when you're up late at night dying from the lurgy that's been hanging around in me for 3 weeks, I've even decided it's time to start to think about the will, which is basically telling Miss Death to sell everything off.
Just to
get the funeral funds together.
I thought we might have been at Ashton Circus with that intro music.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was expecting a couple of monkeys to come on and start juggling balls.
I think you might already have
their own.
Yeah. What else have we got here, Coffin Ed? It's been an incredible week in the news. When you think about it, in South Australia, which is always...
Western Australia.
Well, I mean, it's close enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're
further.
Sniffing seats.
Troy Buswell, who's the leader of the Western Australian Liberal Party.
Which says just about everything.
Now, look, Troy's an old party trick guy. He likes to go around. One of his famous tricks is going
around... Used to be always at Sescourt.
Snapping women's bras.
Bras.
Oh,
which
what
is
a healthy, beautiful, misogynistic little trick that is.
And look, he's actually owned up to sniffing the chair of another woman's chair in 2005. Or
look, it was an incredible Dr. Phil moment because he was breaking out in tears. He was basically, telling the world that unfortunately I've got this problem with my olfactory senses. You ought to get what I've got, swollen polyps, and you'll never have olfactory senses again.
Now, look, you've delved into the realms of the psychosexual, I know, academically, of course.
And well, I thought you were talking about our relationship.
Well, can you explain the fetish, the phenomenon of chair sniffing?
No.
What it's all about?
No. Well, listen, I have no clue.
Gary Manley out of Taxix was telling me recently when he gets friends over to the house, they basically go on Google and what they do is they put two words together and then fetish next to those two words. And no matter what combination they come up with,
there's always
there is a society or a group. So I think a fetish is a fetish. It just happens at a very, you know, provocative time in your upbringing that stays in there like a mantra and defines your sexuality for the rest of your life.
I suppose if you were a chair sniffer, this sort of ultimate...
Yeah, but you know what? Let me just say one thing. Women are not chair sniffers, okay?
Aren't they?
No.
Really?
No.
Well, if you're a male chair sniffer... Mm. Yeah. I guess the ultimate nirvana would be a bit like if you're a necrophiliac working in a funeral parlour, would be working in a theatre or a large stadium where you were the sort of last person in to do the cleaning up.
And yeah, but listen.
I mean, there'd be 2,000 chairs there. I mean, you could
yeah,
just
but
be
you
there
gotta
all
get,
night,
you,
couldn't you?
Look,
you know, the way
from
you're
what
talking
I'm
now
yeah,
tells
you know.
Me you really understand fetishism.
Listen, you've got to get in there, I'm sure, as soon as they stand up, because once a bit of time's gone by,
it's all gone. Over.
Once they splash a bit of disinfectant.
Well, no, I think just time and air.
It's an expedience.
That's right. You've got to be there at the time, otherwise it's all over.
It's like those bricks
going,
through your
going
windscreen.
Going up half an hour later and sniffing, you're not going to get anything, I can tell you now.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Well,
think
maybe people
it.
Could email us on that. Maybe there's some people out there that
there
know a hell of a lot more.
Is there a chair sniffer out there that can give us the mechanics of it?
I don't want a chair sniffer. I just want people to understand that fetish.
Well, the only way you can understand it is to be one.
There might be a female chair sniffer.
I doubt it.
What about a transsexual sniffer?
That doesn't count.
Chipper?
That doesn't count.
Chair sniffer. Anyway, all right.
Anyway, look, if
you're
you've
on
got
the
any comment,
of course.
Studio at FBIRadio.com, particularly if you've got a question for Don Letts coming up later in the program.
Well, let me just do a little bit of a book recommendation here. You're going to have to go to some extent because books that end up on the New York Times bestseller list don't seem to actually get a print run in Australia. Why is that, Coffinhead?
I'm not too sure.
Do you know much about the New York Times bestseller list? Is that the top 100 books selling in the States?
Yes, I think so.
Well, it's good to get on there, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, anyway, I'm astounded this book has got on there, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA by Richard C. Hoagland and Mike Barra. Now, for one moment, don't start to think that this is actually a book about the moon hoax or the moon landing being fake, because it's the absolute opposite of that. Richard Hoagland, for a long time now, has been working with the Enterprise mission and looking at the area of Cydonia, the very controversial area on Mars when the face on Mars appeared. I'll just read a bit from the back cover. For most Americans, the name NASA suggests a squeaky clean image of technological infallibility. Few people are aware of the hard evidence that secret brotherhoods quietly dominate NASA, with policies far more aligned with ancient religious and occult mystery schools. The facade of rational science the government agency has successfully promoted to the world for almost 50 years may be false. Why is the Bush administration intent on returning to the moon as quickly as possible? What are the reasons for the current space race with China, Russia, even India? Remarkable images reproduced within this book provided by the authors about the disaffected NASA employees that give clues to information about our lunar and Martian discoveries. Now, Hoagland was an ex-NASA consultant and CBS News advisor to Walter Cronkite, of all people, and his co-author was a Boeing engineer. And this is an incredible tome, and I just can't believe it's actually gone up there. This is marginalised science being lifted into the mainstream. Because it looks
but
like...
But it is science.
Oh, it's remarkable science, hyperdimensional science in there, but extremely interesting. And the cover contains a photograph unseen by the public until this time, and that's of Buzz Aldrin on the moon holding a Supreme Council flag of the Freemasons. Not many people had realised that Buzz was a 32nd degree Mason.
How did you sneak that on board?
Well, that's interesting. And just prior to exiting the lunar module for their walk around the moon, he gave himself communion.
He must have been having his own World Youth Day.
His own secret handshake.
Yeah. So maybe Buzz will be out here running around the race course and we can ask him a few questions.
Look, we might have more to say about that later on, but we've actually got a question without notice for Miss Death Ree, the chair sniffing. Damien Pendle Hill wants to know if the chair sniffing phenomenon can extend to beanbags and puffs. You know, the pouffet.
Yes, I
know.
That's a dreadful thing. What's that?
Well, of course. I mean, anything that you sit on. That you can transfer your odour to.
Really?
Absolutely. Mm. And somebody rang in before and wanted to know if a bull dyke could be...
Oh, what a dreadful thing.
Well, I suppose they could be...
Listen, Miss Death.
What?
Let's not get into this marginalising fractions of our community out there. And since when have you become an expert on olfactory fetishism?
It's just about, you know, like...
Well, when have you become an expert? Come on.
I haven't become an expert. It's about common sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, think about
it. It's about the Liberal Party in Western Australia and the people they put into power. It's nothing more, nothing less than that.
It is indeed.
You know, it was like a very bad episode of Big Brother, really.
Well, clearly that guy has got problems.
Yeah.
That he was bringing issues that he was bringing to work.
Is there a Big Brother? I doubt it.
I don't think so. What is that? That's I haven't watched it, of course, because I've always had a big thing about, banning watching Big Brother. But, you know, you can't help it sometimes when, the commercials come on every 5 seconds in between other shows, day and night, on Channel 10. But have they totally lost their minds and gone to the freak show element?
Well, I think so. They have to just keep reinventing that dross, don't they? You know.
Well, it seemed pretty bad because I've never watched an episode, any of it, of Big Brother. But it seemed pretty bad before that they had just obnoxious people on, and now they've gotten freaky obnoxious people.
Mm. You know, racist ufologists. I mean, that's a conundrum.
Well, look, I actually did too. You know? On the other night,
you didn't cough for
5 seconds. Everyone in the house had their nose buried in a piece of furniture. So
oh,
I don't
really?
Know what was going on.
It was
on.
A complete outbreak.
Sniffing chairs.
It was a sniffathon, men and women.
Well, there you go. It just shows you. It's like Clinton over there. Everyone was getting a head job. Now everyone's sniffing chairs here. Mm. Our leaders are really poor role models.
Yes, it's the Naked City. You know, the naked one.
The Naked City.
The Naked City on FBI.
Well, one of those very proud moments on the Naked City where we've actually finally got a real guest in. Mr. Don Letts, how are you?
One can short of a six-pack.
Yeah.
I flew in yesterday, so I'm a little bit jet-lagged, but I'm here.
Yeah, it does get to you, those planes, doesn't it? And you're touring with the one and only Dr. El Suavo. How are you, Dr. El Suavo? It's great to see you.
It's good to see you again, Jay Katz and Coffinette. It's always great to see you guys, but actually... I'm touring with the Don, but I'm not performing.
Oh, thank that's God. Sad.
No,
that
but
really... oh, don't say that, Confident, for God's sake.
No, my manager pulled me in to take care of the Don, let's put it that way.
I mean, it's those parlor tricks, really, you know, they're just brilliant. You keep expanding on them, don't
you? I'll do one now for the radio listeners. Have we got a deck of cards in the studio?
No, I think we'll go straight to Don.
Okay, now, it is his show. Now,
Don, you've had an extraordinary career. You are what you call the ultimate Renaissance man, as far as I'm concerned. You're a filmmaker, you're a musician, you're a DJ, you're a writer, you're a commentator. And I think Punk Attitude was a documentary we all needed to see. I mean, my catch cry has been, you know, if the revolution came today, the young people would lock the door and ring Domino's for pizza. And that's one of the sad things. How do you feel about that?
Well, yeah, the children of the West, for the most part, are spoilt brats. But I do have faith.
We've just lost our audience.
No. For the most part.
Yeah.
Luckily for me, I get to travel around a bit and I realise that there are people that don't want to be on MTV and walk the red carpet. They have new values, a little bit smarter than the average bear. And there's always something interesting going on, man. You know, it's like the Force in Star Wars. You cannot stop it. You just got to look in new places.
Where did it all start for you? I mean, you were born in Jamaica. You know, what was the story of actually coming to Britain and all that sort of stuff, linking up with that whole scene in the 70s?
Well, I'd tell you that story if I was born in Jamaica, but actually, I was born and bred in the London, UK.
Oh, really? Well, the info's wrong there, Confident.
That's cool.
That's why you should always do your own research.
My parents were part of what they call the Windrush generation that came over to the UK in the late 50s. I'm actually first generation British-born black. A term that kind of rolls off the tongue now, but when I was growing up, trust me, it was a confusing concept.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten your question, but I'll just go ahead anyway. Mid-70s, the whole punk rock thing kicks off, and I was very interested in not only their musical expression, but more importantly, the whole DIY thing.
Yes.
And, you know, when people like The Clash and The Pistols are picking up guitars, the energy was such that I wanted to pick up something too, so I picked up a Super 8 camera and reinvented myself as a filmmaker.
Gee whiz. And that's when you started doing clips? Is that when the music clips started?
Well, what happened was I started to film the bands that I liked, and luckily I had taste, so I filmed all the great bands. And then I read in this musical paper, the NME, that Don Letts is making a movie, and I'm like, well, that's a good idea, I'll call it a movie. And that was how the punk rock movie was born, and then from there I became friends with all the punk guys and started making all their videos. I mean, for instance, I made all the Clash videos, for instance.
Gee whiz. What an incredible...
Amongst 300 and maybe nearly 400 others.
Gee whiz. And your links there, I mean, you've done...
I did one for the group over here, The Living End.
Oh, yeah, right.
I made a video for them about 15 years ago.
There you go.
Gee whiz. Right. And you've got a great linkage in music there. You've done some extraordinary compilations. You've got a bit of a relationship with Trojan. Tell us about that musical career. Excuse me, I'm dying on air.
Well, without plugging myself, my musical incarnation actually goes back before that because I was in a band called Big Audio Dynamite that I'm really, really proud of with a guy called Mick Jones, some of you might have heard of. That went on for about 8 years. And then let's go to your musical comp question. Over the last few years, I put out about 3 or 4 CD compilations. One was called Dread Meets Punk Rockers Uptown, which is a selection of the stuff I used to play at the Roxy. I then did another called Dread Meets B-Boys Downtown, which was really a document of when I was with The Clash in New York when they did that stint at Bonds, where they played like 23 shows back to back.
God.
The Trojan one to which you're referring to is called Don Letts Presents the Mighty Trojan Sound. And I've got to say, they're all amazing compilations, not because Don Letts put them together, but the period from which I selected the music was a particularly great time for reggae music. And I'm actually currently working on another for Greensleeves Records. It's something I enjoy doing. It's like back in the day, I used to make mixtapes for a lot of the bands like The Pistols and The Clash and Paddy Smith and all kinds of people. So it's very much an extension of the C90.
You must have actually broadened those boys' careers when you think about it. I mean, when you think of, like, Public Image and all those bands, they started to get that dub influence in there, that reggae influence in there. I think you must have had something to do with that.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, you know, I apparently started the punky reggae party, but the truth be told is people like Strummer, Paul Simonon and John Lydon, I mean, they were already familiar with Jamaican music because they grew up next to black people. I think the people that I really turned on were all the people that didn't live next door to black people. And in the mid-70s, that was a lot of people.
Yeah.
So they were the, you know, it's people from like the suburbs and things like that that I kind of turned on. But The Clash and John, they were pretty impressed with my collection, it has to be said.
And what's your, I mean, you've really out-survived a lot of people of that scene. What's your answer to this longevity that you've had?
I'm still broke, man.
You're
so
still
I'm hustling.
Broke.
I'm still out there hustling. It's a creative hustle, but it's a hustle nevertheless. And luckily, it's a hustle I enjoy. Yeah.
And you still...
Do I still enjoy it? Yeah, I still enjoy it, yeah.
And you still, you know, embrace the DIY ethic, I take
it? Oh, man, listen, that's something... I mean, people have got to understand that this punk attitude, it's not something that started in 77 and died in 78. It's an ongoing dynamic. It's part of the lineage of counterculture, and it serves me on a day-to-day basis. I'm still turning my problems into assets. I still believe that a good idea attempted is better than a bad idea perfected. And if you look around these days, folks, there's a lot of bad ideas out there. So this is something that all young people can access. It's not a dead thing that happened back then. It's part of all young people's birthright. If you're brave enough and you've got a good idea, you can be part of this thing too.
Gee whiz, how has that British scene changed from the 70s when all this started, you know?
Whoa, interesting question, because the cultural climate is such that You know, if you look around today, it's almost like punk rock never happened.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we used to say back in the day, never trust anybody over 30. Sometimes when I look around, I think, well,
never trust anyone under 30.
Maybe I shouldn't trust anybody under 30. I mean, having said that, I am an eternal optimist, and I do believe that there are people out there that do have new values, that don't want what the man's offering. And if that's your, you know, your mode of operation, then the world's a beautiful place, man.
Mm. Don, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of the films you've made, particularly on Sun Ra and Gil Scott-Heron and...
Yeah, yeah, all my punk rock friends. Yeah, yeah, I'm showing a selection of my films. I'm not sure what I'm showing. I brought a lot with me, and I might throw it open to the audience so they can vote. But the things I brought with me are documentaries on people, as you've just mentioned, like Sun Ra, George Clinton, Gil Scott-Heron, The Clash. I've just recently done a documentary called Soul Britannia that looks at the impact of black culture on the UK and how it's helped to change the country's identity. There's the Clash docs I've brought with me. I brought a feature film that I did in Jamaica, which I'm tremendously proud of, called Dancehall Queen, which is actually a drama, not a documentary. And I'm jet lagged and I can't remember what else I brought. But I brought some cool stuff.
And what was it like making the film on Sun Ra?
Sun Ra, well, yeah. I have to say it was post-Sun Ra. He was obviously dead when I made it. But it was a trip because, as far as I'm concerned, there's a great example of somebody that didn't have a mohawk, didn't wear safety pins, but was definitely tapped into the punk attitude. Mm. I mean, he was a man that said, you know, jazz is what I say it is, not what you tell me it is. I mean, this guy was pressing up his own records in the late 50s. He had his own label and he was hand-drawing his own record sleeves, you know, way before the punks ever came up with what they thought was a new idea.
Yeah. You do a radio show on the BBC, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Called Culture Clash, which is the same title of my book, Plug. And the tagline for that is, what is my tagline for that? It's crossing time, space, and genres, because the typical perception of Don Letts is that he's at home listening to reggae cranked to 11 all day long, but that's not the case. Reggae's just in my DNA. I mean, who the hell listens to one kind of music except for 10-year-olds? So I'm playing music from, as I just said, across time, space, and genres. Right. So you might hear Sun Ra, you might hear Patsy Cline, along with the Beatles and Bjork and Bob Dylan and whatever else the world's throwing at me. My only thing is that I have to like what I'm playing. I've never played a tune I don't like.
Is that reflected in your DJ set as well? You kind of
absolutely
mix it up
not.
As well?
Yeah, it's not. My DJ set, in fact, would make you think that I am at home listening to reggae 24/7, because it's very much in the spirit of what I did at the Roxy. In other words, it's kind of the history and legacy of Jamaican bass culture. So if you don't like reggae, don't come.
What's the state of the reggae scene in London these days, in Notting Hill, and the whole Sound Clash thing?
Well,
and
reggae is obviously, you know, the thing is that a lot of the experiments that were created through reggae music, for instance, the emphasis on bass, on rhythm, the idea of using the mixing desk as an instrument in itself, you know, they're very much part of the fabric of contemporary music these days. So that, you know, like I say, history and legacy of Jamaican music has quite a wide range, you know.
Right. And
he doesn't look like he believes me, folks.
No, I just
trust me. Come to my show and you'll see what I'm talking about.
You live in Notting Hill, don't you? I'm just wondering what the state of the kind of music scene is there today.
In the UK?
Yeah, in the UK.
Well, if you're not watching MTV and listening to the Top 40, it's great.
Yeah.
You know, like I say, it's like Strummer said, you've got to make sure that your bullshit detector's finely tuned. But there's always something going on, man. Did I just say something I shouldn't have said then?
No, I think that's a really good
because this station looks kind of hip.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I'm in a station here, everyone's looking kind of cool here. There are no suits and ties in here, folks.
Yeah.
No, we can't
but
afford
it. Smells
them.
Good in here. It smells good in here, too. A bit early for that, isn't it?
What did you think of the Temple film on Strummer? Did you like that term or not?
It was a bit of an emotional roller coaster for me because, you know, it's been, what, 5 or 6 years since Joe's died. And after that period of time, you kind of find the place where you've kind of dealt with it. Joe's gone. So to hear his voice right up there, you know, in your face again. And funnily enough, a lot of the early stuff, the voiceover in that, are actually from interviews that I did that were outtakes from Westway to the World. So it was very emotional to me. But there's one thing I've got to say about that whole thing is that, you know, we have to keep these people real.
Yes.
It's no use, you know, mythologizing them and deifying them and putting them on platforms. I mean, the guy's name was Joe Strummer, for Christ's sake. So it's important that we keep these people real, because then it is something that other people can aspire to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I liked it. Yeah, I did.
Have you got any particular...
Maybe it's half an hour too long.
Any particular film projects in the planning stage that you want to talk about?
Funnily enough, I've just done a video for a band and I haven't had a video for ages, because I'm not really into selling product. I'm into selling ideas, and there's not a lot of call for that these days. Anyway, I've just done a music video for a band called Audio Bullies, and one of the attractions was that it's actually called Give Me That Punk. So, you know, they had me. And 2 days ago, before I flew here, I documented a thing called Rock Against Racism, which was a big festival. It's actually the 30th anniversary of a thing that started 30 years ago, would you believe it or not, that the Clash the Clash actually played at in Victoria Park.
Right.
And it had people like The Good, The Bad and The Queen, which is Damon Albarn and Paul Simonon's group. Jerry Dammers was on the bill, The View, Hardfi. There was 100,000 people there. And when I get back to London, I have to edit it. But I'm really looking forward to that, because it's a really worthy cause.
All right. Naked City here, Big Youth. Now look, Don, there's a famous photo of Big Youth with John Lydon. They're sharing a spliff, probably one of the iconic...
Yeah, I was the one that passed him it.
Really?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
That's a great photo, that. It's a seminal photo.
That was taken, back in... What was it? The Pistols had just broken up, and John Lydon was looking to escape the paparazzi. So he decides to go to Jamaica with Richard Branson with the idea of starting a reggae label, which actually was called Frontline. Anyway, I'm John's friend. He says, Don, do you want to go to Jamaica with me? I mean, I figure, you know, he figures I'm black, I must have been. The closest I'd ever been to Jamaica was seeing A Harder They Come in my local cinema. Anyway, 2 days later, I'm in Jamaica with John Lydon, and we're meeting all our reggae heroes. I think we met everybody except Burning Spear, Peter Tosh, and Bob Marley. Actually, I became friends with Bob much later, but we won't get into that. But we spent a month there, and, you know, it was like the jungle drums had gone around the island. Rich white man signing up reggae artist. And there was an exodus of everybody who was anybody besides the three I mentioned looking for a deal. And it was an incredible period for me.
Mm.
And I maximum respect to John for being the first man to take me to Jamaica.
Fantastic.
Consequently, I've been back 100 times, but hey... Nothing like the first.
Yeah,
true.
Have you DJed in Jamaica or?
No, I'm not brave enough. I couldn't get away with what I do in Jamaica, man. No. But I've made one of the things that I'm most proud of. I did a feature film there called Dancehall Queen, which I made around 1977, and I think I've brought it with me.
Right.
So, and that's something that was it was a buzz for me, because the most famous film in Jamaica used to be A Harder They Come, and for me it still is, but it's 30 odd years old now, and now film that all the young people refer to in Jamaica is Dancehall Queen.
All right, and what's that film about?
It's
a
the
story. Yeah.
A Dancehall Queen. Yeah, it's a story. I'll tell you what's interesting about Dancehall Queen is reggae and Jamaica is a very macho society. But when I, through my travels there, I began to realize that it was really the women that were kind of holding the whole thing together. So my story is done from the viewpoint of a woman, which in Jamaica is kind of a big deal, and I think that was the thing that really pleased me most. And it's kind of a rags-to-riches kind of thing, but it really does kind of delve into Jamaican culture. So, if you're into that, come and see Dancehall Queen.
I believe you're a bit of a film buff yourself, too. You've got a very wide knowledge and interest in film.
Yeah. I've got to tell you this, because it'll be relevant to y'all over here. The two things that really got my mind thinking visually was the film A Harder They Come, and the other film that really still one of my favourite films of all time is called Walkabout, directed by Nick Rogue.
Right,
and
yeah.
If you don't know it, Australians, shame on you.
Yeah.
But, visual poetry.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great film, yeah.
Well, he was a cinematographer before he was a director, and it just shows, doesn't it? It's
absolutely
breathtaking, that
I mean,
film.
Another famous thing that he did before that, which you all should see, although it was co-directed with a guy called Donald Cammell, is a thing called Performance.
Oh, yeah.
It actually stars... Mick Jagger.
Yes.
Probably the best thing he's ever done on screen.
Mm. Yeah, we've actually had a friend just in before you, Don, that's created a double bill. We're lacking repertory cinema in this city, like so many cities around the world these days. And thank heavens and
Deliverance.
Yeah.
Performance and deliverance. Yeah. Interesting combination.
Yeah. Yeah.
They both end in A-N-C-E, so yeah. I guess that would do it.
That was part of it. I think that was part of the motivation. How's John Lydon these days?
I don't know, but John Lydon's okay.
Oh, John Lydon, sorry.
I don't know, man. He's living in L.A.
God, I saw him probably three years ago.
I saw him on Judge Judy.
Yeah, Judge Judy, and he won. I don't know if L.A. is any good for anybody except maybe Jack Nicholson.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So he's okay. In fact, he's just played some shows in the U.K., and I think he's coming back to do some more.
And he's still doing those shows as Public Image Limited?
No, it's Sex Pistols.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, the Sex Pistols shows, okay, which I believe were great shows.
I don't know. I'm not a great fan of going backwards. I like to keep moving forwards. I'm a bit like a shark.
Yeah.
With not so many teeth.
I saw him in Chicago and he had a lyric book and I was a little bit worried about that.
Right.
Because there wasn't any new songs in the set, surprisingly.
Well, they only made one album. Yeah. But hey, listen, you know, we cannot take away the fact that the Sex Pistols did kickstart that whole UK punk explosion. I mean,
of course.
You know, Joe Strummer would not be in The Clash if he hadn't seen the Sex Pistols.
So what can we expect from your shows out here?
Ask not what you can expect from me. I want to know what I can expect from you. I mean, you know, I'm doing the whole word, sound and power thing. I'm showing films, I'm talking, I'm promoting my book, I'm DJing. But I'm looking for Australia to turn me on as well. I like to immerse myself in different cultures because, you know, it's like Strummer said again, no input, no output. So, you know, I'm looking at you as much as you're looking at me.
Fantastic.
But we're talking about some serious cultural exchange here, which is, you know, how the whole punky reggae thing came together. I mean, back in those days, we realised that it wasn't by trying to be the same that brought us together, it was by understanding our differences that brought us together. So it's very much in that spirit that I'm here.
What were the punk bands that touched you from our sort of 70s explosion?
From Australia. Well, listen, I've got to be honest with you. Back in the day when I was DJing in the Roxy, I played 99% reggae. I threw in a bit of Dolls, a bit of MC5, a bit of Stooges. And also one other group that I don't know how I picked up to record, but The Saints.
Yes.
Stranded. Yeah. And I can't remember how I got it, but it just seemed to me that that was part of the whole package. So they were in there too. Other than that, I've got to be honest with you all, I'm not that familiar. I like Sia. She's not punk, but I really love that girl's voice. She's got a new album out, folks. Buy it. What else is going on in Australia? Tell me. The Vines are okay. They're Australian, aren't they?
Well, at least they had that moment there where they brought back a bit of Argy Bargy to the stage.
Right.
And, you know, they were affected by the whole commercialisation, and that sort of sent them down commercially. The moment they kicked a photographer's camera when an event they did was heavily sponsored, they were in trouble. So, I mean, this is the culture we're living in. You know, it seems to want that rebellion, but as soon as that rebellion gets too close, bang, it's all over for you.
Yeah, if they can't put it in a box and sell it, it ain't going
to
happen.
Well, I tell you what, I think I might take you to see one of the best punk bands we've had in this country, the Hard-Ons. And they're still going. It's 2008. It's almost, 25 years, and they're playing tomorrow night at the Annandale. So we'll take you for a bit of Australian music.
I mean, just while we're talking about punk bands, I think, you know, again, it's important that people understand that this attitude is not just about sort of loud and fast guitars.
No, it's a lifestyle. These guys have
good,
the lifestyle.
Good. I mean,
they live it.
I mean, I think somebody like Bjork is punk.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
I mean? So,
but she can't knit.
How did the expression, you know, the song Punky
Reggae... close, you don't need to.
Yeah. Okay, look what's happening over here.
The song Punky Reggae Party, how did that sort of title come
Interesting
about?
Interesting story that you've just cued there. While Bob was staying in London, I happened to become friends with him. I mean, I was a smart guy, so I had the best sense in town. And one day I go around to Bob's place and I'm wearing my bondage trousers. And he looks at me and he'd obviously been reading the tabloid papers. He's like, Don Letts, you look like one of them nasty punk rockers. In English, that is, Don Letts, you look like one of those nasty punk rockers. And I'm like, hold on a minute, Bob. You know, these people are my friends. There's something going on here. And he's like, nah, they're nasty. They spit, the blah, blah, blah. And basically, I walked out of there defending my friends, but I walked out of there in a huff. And I actually didn't speak to Bob again until then he died. Anyway, 3 months after that conversation, he was moved and more informed to write the song Punky Reggae Party. Wow. Because he looked behind the tabloid headlines and realised that they were really sort of like-minded rebels. Mm. And whilst he might not have liked their wardrobe, he kind of dug their spirit.
So we can put that down to your bondage pants, definitely.
Well, partly that. I mean, I think the truth, I mean, the whole part of that story is that after we had that conversation, he was living in London for like another 3 or 4 months. And certain people had turned him onto the fact that, yes, there was something going. But I was proud that I was able to hold my corner and defend my friends.
Mm. Can you go right back and tell us a little bit about the clothing shop, the Acme Fashion that you used
Acme
to work in?
Acme Attractions. Yeah. Well, back in the mid-70s, the people like myself, black people and sort of my like-minded white mates, there weren't any kind of clubs that we could attend to. They had all these funny door policies, like you had to have a suit and you couldn't wear hats or whatever. So the shops actually performed the function of clubs where like-minded people could meet. And there were two shops. There was my shop, Acme Attractions, and then there was a shop run by Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood called Sex. And all these disaffected youth would move between these two shops. I think more people hung out in my shop simply because you could buy a pair of trousers in my shop for £15, whereas in Vivian and Malcolm's shop, they were £50. And they also liked the fact that I was pumping hardcore dub reggae all day long. So, yeah, that's where we began to form friendships. And out of those meetings came all these other ideas.
Right. That must have been an incredibly exciting time to live in London, wasn't it?
It was one of the happiest times of my life, I have to say. One of the few things I would go back to.
Right.
Well, I mean, that punk attitude should still be alive. And I think it really is what you've been saying before. It's that general idea of questioning our notion of authority and convention. And this is what I worry about. I worry about this with the Heritage Band, that we're actually just, people are falling back into a product. They're becoming consumers more than they are creators.
I don't know, man, tell me about it. This whole thing of, you know, where the youth have become like, what are they? They're like, they've gone into this sort of passive consumerism and they're totally kind of emotionally disconnected from the planet. And you know, look at the state of the planet. I mean, I think people need to, just like in the punk days, you know, revel in individuality, become more politicized and get involved, man. You know, we all know what the problem is. What we need is some solutions.
Yeah, we can only do that together. I mean, together we're a strong force. What do you think about, you know, the stories in that time of musicians like Bob Marley being a threat so much to the system that they might have been actually taken out by the system? Do you hold any validity to that sort of stuff?
I'll have to go and talk to Oliver Stone about that. I mean, the thing is that anybody upsets the status quo is going to get stick. But, I mean, what else are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know,
you
either work for the man or you work against the man. And I know what side of the fence I'm on.
Yeah.
You
know. Now, we need to get those dates for your shows. And we've just lost the promoter. Let me go and grab him. And maybe you've got another question for Don there, Colin.
Yeah, well, Tuesday night you've got a little bit of a private screening. Here's the promoter, Jeff, just returning.
Sorry.
Did you go to the toilet in the middle of this?
Yeah. No, I had a pressing phone call.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The show's this week, Jeff. Are we going to mention Tuesday night?
Yeah, I think we should because it's a very limited capacity and it's...
It'll be a very intimate gig.
Naked City's presenting it in conjunction with Intense Touring and it's at the Mew Mew Sun Archives. What time are we going to open the doors?
We're going to open the doors at 7:30. You get there at 7:30, you'll get a seat.
We're starting right on 8. Don't turn up at 10 past.
It's going to be a beautiful evening, that
That's
one.
That's what I'll do.
And where's the other dates?
And the big one is the 10th, Saturday the 10th at the Manning Bar.
Yes.
And the doors open at 8 o'clock and there'll be a little bit of time before the actual show starts. We might maybe show some of the new Clash doco you've done or something, you know, a bit of music.
And you're doing, you're going right around the country?
Yep, we're doing every state except for the Northern Territory.
Beautiful. Yeah. Incredible.
Well, that's not a state. So, yes, we are doing every state in Australia.
Okay. Well, look, it's been such a pleasure having you on. We feel really privileged, and it's great to have you back in this country, Don. We look forward to seeing you on Tuesday night. Take good care. And maybe Monday night you'll drop in and see the Brainiac.
Dr. El Suavo's back in the studio all of a sudden. Believe me, the Brainiac is a must. We'll be down there.
All right. Fantastic.
Beautiful. Okay, thanks for the
Space. Thanks, Don. Cheers. Thanks.